Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of Africa this Monday, January 6, 2025. New traffic directives anger motorists in South Sudan, and the UN peacekeepers say violence still exists in the country. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Lawyers representing over 30 hotels in South Sudan have sued the government of South Sudan in the East African Court of Justice for what they called unpaid hotel and accommodation services rendered to government officials. They are seeking over $60 million in punitive and general damages. South Sudan's Justice Minister Ruben Madol Arol refused to speak to this program, telling us that we should make a request through what he calls official diplomatic channels. Wani Santo Jada is the lead lawyer for the pontiffs. He tells my colleague James Batty the failure to pay for the hotel services violates principles of East African community.
We are not planning to sue. We have already sued them on the 31st of December 2024. The summons out from the East African Court. The government has been given 45 days to file defense under Rule 28 of the East African Rules of Procedure. So we are suing them basically for failure to settle the claims to the hotels. The government decided to bring the rebels and accommodate them in the hotels in Juba. So they have been there, and they have not been paid since January. They keep writing to the government about payment. And most of the hotels here are owned by foreigners and some owned by South Sudanese. So we decided to go to court so that the court has to rule and order the Republic of South Sudan to pay these investors.
So how much in monetary damages are your clients demanding from the South Sudan government?
We are demanding $44 million, but with interest, 10% interest per year. For all these years, it has reached to $61 million. We are demanding $61 million United States dollars from the government.
Did you try to negotiate this with the government to reach an amicable settlement?
Yeah, this is a very good question. We wrote a letter to the Minister of Justice, and a letter was written to the head of the Constitutional Committee, Truth, the Lord, the Secretary of the for the President. And we later got a letter on the 12th of December 2024. And in that letter, one of the paragraphs indicated that the settlements will be concluded within 7 days. But I got the letter on the 22nd, when the 7 days have elapsed. On the 23rd, I got a letter from the Minister of Justice, the Attorney General of the Republic of South Sudan. But again, that letter is having a lot of issues. That letter has not indicated when will the settlement start. It is just an open check. So I just wait by next buying time, because a candidate lawyer or a vigilant lawyer will know the committee. Have your position paper.
So you are going to the East African Court of Justice. Does the court have any jurisdiction over the government of South Sudan?
The East African Court has jurisdiction as long as you have invoked Article 6 and Article 7 of the treaty establishing the East African Community. Article 6 and 7 of the treaty requires the partner states to adhere to the principle of rule of law, human rights, accountability, and social justice, including good governance. Now, failure to protect investors in South Sudan is just an abuse of rule of law. Secondly, failure to pay all these claims by the National Constitutional Committee, it shows that this country or this particular state has poor governance. So we need to show to the court the aspect of poor governance in that particular state. So the court immediately will have the reduction in respect to poor governance and rule of law.
When would the case come to trial in the East African Court of Justice?
The rule requires the parties should to file their defense within 45 days. So the 45 days will start running from yesterday.
That's Wani Santino Jada, the lead lawyer for the pontiffs who have sued the government of South Sudan for lack of payment of hotel bills. He was speaking to my colleague James Batty from the capital Juba earlier today. A Kenyan senator is calling for a Commonwealth judicial inquiry to investigate the alleged abductions and disappearance of activists and critics of the administration. Okiya Omtatah also says that he expects the security institutions to respect a recent court ruling which ordered the release of all abducted citizens within 7 days. The senator is receiving medical treatment following his arrest by police during recent protests. He warns that there would be more demonstrations in Kenya if the detained citizens are not released. Senate Okiya Omtatah tells my colleague Peter Cloti that an external judicial investigation can find out those involved in the alleged disappearance of Kenyans.
An unfortunate thing has been happening in the country since we had the July 25th storming of the parliament of Kenya by young people who are dissatisfied with the nature of the way the country is being governed. And so at the end of the day, they began arresting and kidnapping people and forcing them to disappear from the streets. Two of them are people who disappeared from the streets after leaving my office, two young people. And so there's been pressure mounting across the country that these people should be released. And even if anybody have done a mistake or violated the law, due process of the law should take place. Because over 80 people are now missing. So, and that's why I went ahead and filed a habeas corpus application to compel the police to release them and other state organs. And the court has granted them 7 days within which to release these people. Some have been held for more than 4 or 5 months, others for days. And so it's a demand we're making across the country that we cannot allow our country to go back to lawlessness.
You believe next week coming, the government would have to respond to the court order after the ultimatum of a week?
Yes, we expect by the time we get to Tuesday next week, it should be very clear the people should have been released. Otherwise, we're going to have a lockdown in Nairobi.
Why do you say there will be a lockdown? Are you not threatening the country's territorial integrity and peace?
No. It's part of enforcing the Constitution. We have a Bill of Rights, which under Article 29 guarantees one the safety of the individual and freedom of movement. Article 49, which says what you should do with arrested people is to arraign them in court within 24 hours or to let them go. But this thing is that people are being snatched off the street and disappeared. They don't leave interest. You can't get interest where they are. Some have been released to tell you about horrifying stories of how they were tortured and told that should they repeat doing what they are doing, they would be killed, stuff like that. So I don't see any threat in what I've said, because it's what we are going to do. It's not a threat. It's what we are going to do.
What do you mean by a lockdown? What do you mean by that?
We want to get the masses out, the masses of civilians to come out and join in the call for the people to be set free. So there'll be a situation whereby Nairobi and other major urban centers will have massive demonstrations to demand that the young people who have been kidnapped are set free. Because the kidnapping has not only targeted these people, our Kenyans. We've had cases whereby people are kidnapped, Ugandans who are kidnapped in Kenya and produced in court in Uganda.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps in addition to the court order, an investigation should be carried out to find out those who are allegedly abducting Kenyan citizens. Where do you stand on that?
I think maybe a proper word would be a judicial inquiry, an inquiry under a judge. And we would want a judge from the Commonwealth, because the Commonwealth judges have got same jurisdiction in Kenya. We would want judges from the Commonwealth, members of the Commonwealth, be it India, be it wherever, Australia, be it Britain and stuff. We will not be open to a judicial inquiry. An investigation by the very police will not yield much. There will not be an opportunity for them to confuse us further. But before even going to an inquest, the people have to be produced, the bodies have to be produced, because they were taken off the streets by security forces, and there's no reason why the security forces cannot be responsible enough to release these youngsters.
That's Kenyan Senator Okiya Omtatah speaking with VOA's Peter Cloti earlier over the weekend. 2024 was a year of conflict with wars in Gaza and Ukraine, claiming many thousands of lives. Africa also played its part with conflicts in Sudan, ongoing rebel attacks in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, terrorism across the Sahel region, and civil strifes in several countries, including Mozambique. Some analysts tell VOA's Darren Taylor that the prospects of peace in 2025 is not looking good.
The United Nations projects 305 million people will require humanitarian assistance in 2025, many because of conflict and many in Africa. It says 400 million children live in war zones or are trying to flee them. Juan Chavez Gonzalez, an expert in humanitarian action at the UN, says it's becoming increasingly difficult to help victims of war.
Conflicts in places where colleagues are probably going to go deeper into, like in Sudan, Ukraine, Gaza, are incredibly deadly, and the needs are extremely complex, and the human condition is really on the edge of a precipice in many of these places. So delivering assistance in these highly volatile, insecure environments, it's not just an issue of whether we have enough resources. It's also operationally very, very complex.
During a recent online event presented by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Gonzalez said extreme weather events caused by climate change have made humanitarian assistance much harder. In Sudan, for example, the UN is helping refugees fleeing war, drought, and floods. This has worsened human suffering, with Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, the Sahel, and Somalia as some of the flashpoint areas. Jonathan Madjok, director of the Refugee and Forced Displacement Initiative at the Wilson Center, a research institute in Washington, D.C., says conflict and its causes have become increasingly complex, making wars hard to end.
Sudan, there are multiple players in there. More refugees are located now in urban areas than the traditional refugee camps. And that again become more of development challenges because people are living in cities. That is a policy focus that should switch from the traditional way where we view refugees as a temporary phenomenon living in the camp, for example, and they will return home tomorrow. That is not the issue now.
In the Sahel, he says, new terrorist groups are springing up all the time, joining the fight against government troops and Russian forces. Majok says most refugees are now hosted by low to middle-income countries, which affects their economies. He says wealthier countries are no longer willing to take many asylum seekers. Majok expects this to continue in 2025, with the United States and European countries in particular enforcing legislation that makes it difficult for people to claim asylum. What's also changed recently, says Jochen Rieg of the Norwegian Refugee Council, is that many armed groups are not allowing aid into conflict zones.
Changes to the geopolitical dynamics and the rise of non-traditional actors, I think, is one key piece we're looking at. And we see these developments, especially in the Sahel, where our usual engagement to influence actors, to leverage, are not working any longer. Humanitarians are mostly the only international actor. So humanitarians are often being used as for political purposes.
Rieg says that as long as the world's primary means of ending conflict, the UN Security Council, remains divided, there's little hope of ending the world's wars in 2025. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Chinese are coming to Africa. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands. That is craft work. making the baskets and doing more of the clay artwork.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers. So for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice. So I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi began a tour of Africa Sunday to Nigeria, Namibia, Chad, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The visit is expected to last from January 5th to 11th. David Aworawo is a professor of international relations and strategic studies at the University of Lagos. He tells reporter Mike Bonye, the Chinese foreign minister's visit is aimed at consolidating Chinese diplomatic engagement in Africa.
It's a good one, and it is not unusual. It is what China has done consistently in the past 35 years, since 1990, that their first foreign visit in any new year has been to Africa consistently during this period. And during this period also, Chinese activities in Africa have expanded diplomatic engagement, trade, investment, infrastructure development. All of these things have expanded in the past 35 years, during which period they have visited Africa consistently early in the year. So, it's a good thing. Hopefully it would further expand Chinese bilateral relations with Africa and, of course, trade, investment. All of those things have benefited China and also Africa as well. So it's in line with Chinese diplomatic activities in the past over three decades.
Sir, what do you make of this visit, especially coming before the inauguration of U.S. President-elect Donald Trump? Do you think the Chinese want to preempt U.S.-African policy, or do you think the Chinese are playing a fast one to make sure that they have a grip of the continent before Donald Trump is inaugurated?
I don't think it is in competition with the United States as such, because it's something that China has done consistently in the past 35 years, since 1990. Their first visit outside China in every new year has been to Africa during this period. It is just a coincidence that it is taking place at a time when an American president has a policy of America first, and that first also counter all the other great powers is to be inaugurated. I think it's just a coincidence. It will be good for Africa because expectedly the United States, I mean under Trump, would want to respond quickly to see how China would, or the United States would also expand its activities in Africa. You recall that in December 2018, when Donald Trump introduced the Prosper Africa Initiative, it was in response to Chinese increasing activities in Africa so that the United States will not be left behind. Of course, everybody recognizes Africa's immense potentials in terms of resources, in terms of human capital and all that.
That's Mike Bonye speaking with a professor at the University in Lagos. 6 days of official funeral ceremonies marking the life and the legacy of the 39th U.S. President Jimmy Carter are underway in his home state of Georgia, where VOA's Ken Farabaugh has more.
The sun rises over Plains, Georgia, differently these days for shop owner Philip Kurland, as he and others in this rural community of about 700 people mourn the passing of its most famous resident, Jimmy Carter.
We were hoping we were going to be planning his 101st birthday, but the realization is he'll be with Rosalind. He'll be in a far better place, and he's really done as much as he can for the community and for the world at this point.
While he was known by the codename Deacon to the Secret Service officers who protected him for nearly five decades through more than 140 different countries, Jimmy Carter is more than a former president and humanitarian to those who lived alongside him in the place he called home for a century. As Carter's hearse and motorcade made its way through the town at the beginning of 6 days of funeral activities, Curlin reflected on Carter's personal impact on him.
There goes my hero.
It's the beginning and the end.
Jill Stuckey is a Carter family friend and superintendent of the Jimmy Carter National Historical Park, which includes his Depression-era boyhood farm outside Plains, where the funeral motorcade paused on its journey through Georgia.
So a president starts planning their funeral the day after they're elected. This has been planned for decades.
A plan Stuckey and others are faithfully fulfilling as Carter's flag-draped coffin made its way through Georgia.
I haven't grieved yet. I'll probably grieve when it's all over with.
Kim Fuller is Jimmy Carter's niece, the daughter of his well-known brother, Billy Carter. She's also his neighbor in Plains and carries on his legacy at Maranatha Baptist Church, where Carter taught Sunday school lessons since leaving the White House in 1981. While she admits the funeral activities are keeping her busy, there are difficult moments of reflection.
It kind of, something just kind of flooded over me. I'm saying, you know, we're doing this because he's dead. He's gone. And I had to go outside, you know. So there are moments when it hits me just overwhelmingly.
As members of the U.S. military stand at attention at Carter's flag-draped coffin at the Carter Center in Atlanta, thousands of visitors like Atlanta resident Walter Ramsey have one final opportunity to connect with Georgia's only president.
I wasn't alive for his presidency, but this really helps make it feel like you know Jimmy.
People will continue to pay their respects to President Carter in repose here at the Carter Center until Tuesday. That's when he'll be transported to the National Capital Region for official ceremonies there, before he returns to Georgia on Thursday, July 9th, when the official ceremonies take place in his hometown of Plains, Georgia, which will also be his final resting place. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Atlanta, Georgia.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
That's all we prepared for you on this Monday, January 6, 2025. I must tell you, we are here under a snow cover. It took me actually 3 hours to come for this show. We'll now leave you with Burna Boy and the song Last, Last.
My life into my job and I know I'm in trouble. She manipulate my love, oh. I know holy and I know that kepo. Like if I fry yo, my eye, oh. Don't cry yo. I need to go and shadow. 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 Shadow. Obama. I dey try to buy moto, one Toyota Corolla. My feelings been dey swing like Django Lover. Feelings been dey swing like Django Lover. Now you crash your Ferrari for Lekki Bona. Now some more to remain, could have been all over. My feelings today swing like Django Lover. Feelings today swing like Timbani catch you, at you. Come on, why don't you finish you? Why you say I did nothing for you? And if I do anything you want me to do. I do anything you want me to do. Maybe I'm not
We've been listening to Burna Boy and the song Last Last. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaru, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, we wish you a lovely evening. And remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Crash your Ferrari for Lucky Bonner. Now see Martin remake could have been all over. My feelings today swing like Django Lover. Feelings today swing like Timbanik at you, at you. I'm a white dog in Fenisu. Why you say I did nothing for you? And if I do anything you want me to do, Timbanik at you, at you. I'm a white dog in Fenisu. Why you say I did nothing for you? And if I do
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It was a call for a moment of silence that spoke so loudly the Russian government could not bear it. At a Moscow City Council meeting in March 2022, City Councilor and human rights defender Alexei Gornov urged that the meeting begin with a moment of silence to remember the children and other victims who were dying in Russia's war against Ukraine. A few weeks later, Gornov became the first person arrested under Russia's war censorship laws. For one thing, he was accused of calling Russia's invasion of Ukraine a war instead of a special military operation. In July 2022, Gornov was convicted of spreading false information about the Russian army. Russian judge Olesya Mendeleeva sentenced Gornov to 7 years in prison. On December 31st, the United States imposed sanctions on Olesya Mendeleeva for her role in the arbitrary detention of Alexei Gornov. Mendeleeva was designated under the Global Magnitsky Sanctions Program, which targets perpetrators of serious human rights abuse and corruption around the world. In a statement announcing the sanctions, the U.S. Department of the Treasury noted that during Gornov's trial, Mendeleeva, who is known for her long and harsh sentences, refused to consider the defense witnesses' testimonies and reasoned that Gornov's reformation would be impossible without imprisonment. The Treasury Department also observed that Alexei Gornov has suffered physical abuse and denial of medical treatment in detention. Russia's manipulation of its legal system silences dissent and suffocates the truth about Russia's indefensible war against Ukraine, said U.S. Acting Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Bradley Smith in a statement. In a separate statement, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller declared, "The United States stands in solidarity with the Russian people who face threats, violence, reprisal, and imprisonment from Russian Federation authorities for exercising their human rights and fundamental freedoms in their own country. We call for Gornov's immediate and unconditional release and the release of all others whom the Russian Federation has arbitrarily detained. We remain committed to promoting accountability for serious human rights abuses in the Russian Federation."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.